You were the Capital Center's first practitioner who became a creative fellow. And you came to the Capital Center with a proposal to think about a fellow, to think about diaspora, to think about the griot, the storyteller. And the thing I think that right from the beginning captured my imagination was the question you proposed, that this is a story of Othello that's been going on for 400 years. And the question you wanted to know was whether there was a way for Othello to escape from the end of the story alive. So that was what you came to us with. And I just wonder whether you could tell me a little bit more about what your thinking was as you started this project. Because it's an ongoing research project for you, isn't it? And I wonder if you could just kind of talk about that a bit.
Well, there's so many ins to that, but I suppose it started from my personal position within the historical and ongoing relationship between Britain, the West, and Africa, and specifically Sierra Leone and Britain, Sierra Leone being a former colony. And I saw certain parallels, or felt certain affinities to Othello as somebody who's moved, who's in exile, who goes through a process of acculturalization within somewhere in the West, etc. And as that particular story has been played out for 400 years, so too has our story between Britain and Sierra Leone, Africa and the West, being played out in so many different ways. So, and Othello continually never gets out.
Yeah.
And we're in a situation, the human race, the global relationships that we have, where we need to have certain solutions or paradigms to approaching solutions revolving around difference, conflict, and the legacy of history. So I thought, well, if that's posing the question if Othello could escape the story and why he doesn't, or how might he, might present an interesting narrative application for our real life situations. Mm-hmm. So that was the original thinking. But the actual project that was proposed to Capital was more specifically around Shakespeare as a lingua franca to encourage an intercultural dialogue and learning. And we didn't go down the Othello escaping from the story route, specifically because the RSC were hesitant or reluctant or concerned about causing distress to the participants, because apparently race and history and empire might have precipitated distress, which is understandable because it has precipitated distress, certainly if you've been on the receiving end.
Absolutely.
Of empire's benevolent attentions. So we respected the RSC's sensitivities to race, empire, and history, and configured the workshop or hothousing around cultural aesthetics and interculturality as it's played out in British context. And it was fruitful. I'm very grateful for their sensitivities, because it meant that, because you have to understand that the Capital Project was part of 12 hothousing interventions that that I undertook as a history ensemble player during 2006-2008. So the Capital Project was one phase of thinking. There'd been two that had carried out previously, and a further two that had started from 2004. So the particular formation of the Capital Project then centered around, okay, suppose we got individuals from a diaspora context that were resident in Britain and set up a situation where they would be able to engage with citizens who happen to be students at Warwick University. But they are citizens of this country. So that was the context. And whether the way Marcello approaches performance, and therefore maybe Shakespeare, and therefore Othello, and the way I do from Sierra Leone, a British Sierra Leone diaspora experience, the way I or Thomas does.
Okay, let's just go back there, yeah. So that we can introduce, as it were, players, yeah. In this whole thing. As we started out, you started out by giving for everybody who wanted to in the university a performance of The Man Who Committed Thought.
Yeah.
And out of that became the kind of the basis of a story that you were telling, that you were using, as it were, to springboard the Othello from. And that, in a way, established your physical performance style, but also your storytelling style as your own lingua franca, that then was carried over into the project, which had, what, 10 students, 12 students?
12. Yeah.
12 students who were engaged for a whole week,
yeah.
Working with you to develop further ideas that came out of The Man Who Committed Thought, but that were also attached to the story of colonization, of black
exile.
History, of exile.
Shared history.
Shared history, but also the thing that I found from the beginning kind of most challenging and important was the idea of the storyteller, the griot.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say something about that, because I also think it struck students there as, although they have been told stories all their lives, they come at story from the point of view largely of readers, either the bedtime story that is read to them, or the more developed stories that they read when they start going to school, or now at university they're reading the classic literature of the white Western world. But you were taking them back to a different space, a different cultural space, a different historical space that says we all have stories. We are all storytellers. What is your story? Here is my story. But you were also establishing for them, through the griot, the idea that the story has a cultural space, and that a story does cultural work, that the story is told in order to adjust history and adjust the relationship with your cultural
mediate the present. Well, the griot...
So who is the griot?
Well, the griot is, I mean, I'm not a griot. I'm inspired by the griot and the function of griotism, and that it is a very specific classical form that has practical relevance to social equilibrium and transformation within communities and within society. So I was inspired by that and tried to find a personal response to storytelling using that model. So the griot in most parts of Africa, but especially Mali, the West Africa, and coming down to the south, let's take Mali. The griot from the 12th, 13th century was a highly respected and valuable storyteller, oral historian, musician, a repository of history, parables, an improvising, he would be the Times, the Sun, the Daily Mirror, all in one. And he had incredible training, and he had a very specific position in the society that nobody tampered with. He'd been training from a little boy, his memory and the genealogies of families, royal families, etc., etc., and all the major events in that community or society's histories he would have. So when he appeared at weddings or, you know, or diplomatic situations or whatever it might be, where mediation and communication had to occur, he would be there. And he would adapt these various skills and various knowledges according to the situation. So if the situation was hot and it needed cooling down, he would adapt and configure these various interdisciplinary genres in order to address that situation. If the situation was cold, he would heat it up. So if he needed to be diplomatic and the rulers needed to hear a particular instruction because of his knowledge that he contained. But he needs to be diplomatic. He might improvise. He might come into a parable, you know, and add on a bit of history, you know, to, but everyone would know exactly, get the message. And so I was fascinated by this, by the flexibility and by the very clear, not just entertainment, very clear element of social responsibility that was running through the storyteller. You know, you couldn't divorce, even now, you know, Yusuf Ndour, who's a great musician, he's known globally, but if you go to Senegal, his work, his fruits of his work is connected with the community, you know. Whereas I found it interesting here, communities like separate from the mainstream, yeah. And theatre is sort of over there, do you know?
Yeah.
And
but one of the things that...
Yeah, so my interest in griotism was how could that model help to connect these different spaces and the people in these different spaces a little bit more organically.
Mm-hmm. But one of the things that immediately did for students, and thinking about lingua franca, the language that we all speak, they think of that in terms of vocabulary that they have access to, or images that you know that strike them as important. But what you did for them was immediately to show them that Othello is built on all of these textures of stories.
Yeah.
So when Othello says, "Send to the Sagittari, ask Desdemona, get Desdemona to come and tell the story of what happened, and listen to her as evidence. And in the meantime," says the Doge, "tell it, Othello," and he starts telling a story.
Precisely.
So her father loved me, oft invited me. But there's that story, but there's Roderigo's story, there's Michael Cassio's story, there's late in the...
Well, that's Shakespeare.
Yes.
That Shakespeare is...
As storytelling.
Shakespeare does that. He uses... Shakespeare is very... Shakespeare is Griot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted... young people, anybody, to begin to understand and appreciate the common ground that we share from different cultures. And Shakespeare does this, history, proverbs, biblical narrative, you know, and he looks at things from different points of view. What is Desdemona's point? What is Othello's? What is Lodovico? What is Romeo? What is, you know, he changes the camera angle.
Yes.
And so does the Griot.
Okay. But to get at Shakespeare's story, you weren't just going to the Shakespeare and thinking about the Shakespeare as an analogy for the story that you wanted to tell. You were also putting pressure on those students to find and tell their own stories. And they found that challenging, I think, because you have an interesting story. You know, you're multicultural, you come from Sierra Leone, you lived in Barbados, you have multiple voices, you can speak different languages that are not just foreign languages, but also accented voices that put you in different worlds. And you put the pressure on them to find and tell their story. Was that important to you?
We didn't practically get down to really letting them release their own specific story because of time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to do. That was the point, but we were only given a week. But nevertheless, what we did do was that through the characters within Othello, they were given specific strategy and license, for instance, to hang on to the text, but also to come off it. So in that, and because they were all, people played the same characters. It wasn't like you had one person playing Othello.
Yeah.
So that what that did was allow, say, Maria to be Desdemona at one time, and maybe at another point in the hothousing process, she was another character. Mm-hmm. And because she could paraphrase and come off, she had that license to let in maybe her own voice, her own feeling, her own appreciation of that particular situation that particular character was in at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, that was a kind of telling your story through a character.
Let me go a different direction with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because immediately, you were asking them to think about a physical vocabulary as well. And so you started them moving. And I think maybe that one of the first things that you did was to connect movement with sound. So you started them drumming.
Yeah.
You brought into the space that we were, the rehearsal room that we were using, you brought in drums, you brought in shakers, you brought in different kinds of things
song.
To make.
Song.
But, and then through the drumming, through the physical making of the music, you started them singing. And that started them into another language. So could you talk about the physical in this project?
I prefer not to talk about the physical because I prefer to talk about ritual.
Okay.
And the purpose of ritual, the mechanism, the communal binding nature of ritual, which involves, as Ayo Thomas says, right at the end of the Othello showing, back home, and indeed in China and all these other places, And in England as well, with the Morris dance, you know, before we got very hooked up on intellectual prowess. He says, in back home, most of the time we don't have onlookers.
Right. No spectators.
Most of the time we don't have onlookers, right? So if we're all participating, what are we participating in? And what are we participating with? Well, we're participating with the things that we all have, voices and bodies. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's the first thing. We now talk about physicality, but, you know, I'm into an African, that's like, why are you separate? Why is that like a separate thing? You know, you can't exist without being physical in a space. You know what I mean? So within ritual, you have song, dance, and to sing and to dance and to move and to walk, you need a body, and everybody has bodies. So that's, it's really funny because all this workshop's doing and almost all anybody from Southern sensibilities or Southern narratives are doing is having to break down what we have been doing for centuries. That's what we're doing. Mm. Just right, like reversing reverses the split and, you know, trying not to be too black about it and stuff like that. But really, and your anthropologists and etc., and even during colonial times, they all studied this and they all know this. What's interesting for me is why it's taking so long when it's quite obvious. But anyway, bringing ritual into the space gave, it's a very human thing to contact each other. And the metaphysical unknowable, that's what ritual is about. So all we did, Marcello, Ayo, myself, and Alison, and what the RSM, whenever you do theatre, it's about ritual. So in our culture, we have still very, you know, very defined rituals for specific life transitions. And they're nearly all, well, they always include the, what Boal talks about, the spectactor. He calls it spectactor. We just call it being a community. But if you say community now in England, it's like people with housing problems. You know, but, you know, the village. So all we did was introduce elements to make the group feel like a village. And this is borne out, actually, by three of the participants who responded a year later, who all said they weren't actors, they weren't, you know, they didn't even know that they were, some thought it was just going to, they're going to just read from a text. Yeah. They didn't want to be actors, and they were extremely uncomfortable on the first day. I remember Tom Johnson saying he just thought, I'm way out of my league here. But by the end of it, within a week, they all felt very comfortable and they felt that they had a release of physicality and so on and so forth. And I feel that was because the elements of ritual, they as themselves, not that they were good at drumming or they had drumming in their backgrounds, but because ritual is about being human and connecting with each other. And as soon as that was made clear and they felt that, oh, this isn't about being a good drummer or good dancer or good singer or good mover, this is about being with each other, then they were able to let themselves go and in the process discover limitations or discover strengths. Like Eleanor
Tony.
Walpole said, I didn't feel, she said, as you can see from the video, I'm not a very good mover, but that's something I think I can really work on. Or the other Eleanor said, I'm not an actor, I'm more a writer and a director. But she went on to do performance, you know, to select a performance module, et cetera, which meant that she she felt somehow the process of ritual legitimized her own personal way or story of moving her body. Her own personal way of moving her body, not comparatively to an expert dancer.
It's fascinating that from the time our children are tiny, what we acculturate them to is to sitting separately and to sitting in a space and not kind of exploding out of that space, but keeping their hands on their lap and paying attention, you know, paying attention to the reading or the project or whatever. And what you were doing was to take them back to a time before that was the cultural norm and asking them really to connect their head to their feet and then helping them do that. But I wonder if you could say something about the way Marcello Magni helped, because you worked with Marcello and with Catherine Hunter in Complicité, and you brought Marcello in really to help the process of working towards ritual, towards this making of the village. Marcello himself has a really interesting cross-cultural background, and is this just kind of explosive presence in the rehearsal room. But he too was challenging students, and I remember Eleanor feeling very attacked almost, feeling very defensive because she couldn't do something. And she said in reflection that she wasn't ready to be pushed. But then by day three, she was ready to be pushed. And Marcello just kept pushing and pushing. I just wonder whether you could say something about what he was doing for you and for the project.
By the way, I've worked, Marcello and Catherine are part of the Complicité family, Complicité experience. I haven't directly worked with Complicité, but have followed, been in their workshops, and there was one Complicité presented, Complicité production that was presented by Complicité, but Annie Castle died and Catherine was in it and Marcello was in it. So really that relationship came because they are open to difference, because they themselves have found, you know, Catherine is Greek origin, American, and brought, you know, went through a RADA experience. Marcello has trained in about three, you know, with Lecoq, Gaulier. He's very connected physically, and as an individual, he's very open to learning new experiences. So, and all the participants, I thought it would be interesting that all of us that have a diasporic or exile heritage experience, to put us in the same room with citizens that I believe and live and work in a diasporic world in any case. And I believe that they contain this. I mean, if you have Aretha Franklin in your record collection, then you are connected with diasporic experience. So that was the impulse, rather than it just being me. Because had it just been me, it would have been a black thing. I believe it would have been. So that was the, and also he's very rooted in a particular European tradition that is about moving and singing and being together and so on and so forth. Marcello is Italian, family, community, eating together, sitting together, being loud, laughing, you know. And I thought, okay, and so are we. And because of my professional relationship with Marcello over the years, I found that his openness and Catherine, because they're both, for instance, right from 1991, when they first saw me on stage, they were very interested in hearing English spoken differently or sounding different. And that really stayed with me, because I didn't find that openness really, well, anywhere else, actually. I mean, they were leading directors and performers in the country, and they were saying, well, it's great to hear English spoken differently and with different accents, et cetera, et cetera. So when it came time for me to do my project, I thought, well, rather than just have me, why wouldn't it be good to have his diasporic experience and performance pedagogy, as well as Ayo Thomas, who trained in theatre arts in Nigeria, but also you know, he's steeped in the traditional cultures, but also has a diasporic sensibility because he's moved. Also, Nigeria was a colony at one time, so he has his access to Shakespeare, this kind of bi-cultural or tri-cultural sensibility. And then Jabel speaks French, but he's from Senegal. He plays traditional instruments and is connected with story from another cultural trampoline. And then mine, and then Alison, who is averse Shakespeare,
yeah.
Who also actually is, her roots are from Eastern European.
Right.
You know, so she has this thing of, where am I from, and am I not, you know, she has a different sensibility, although, and she's located herself within teaching people how to speak and how to engage with verse or any kind of text within the English language. So by putting all these people together, it was almost a hothousing to hear each other, because that's very rare that we can hear each other, or directors or leading facilitators hear each other and watch each other work,
yeah.
As well as the participants to engage with us in that way. And Marcello's pushing comes from his tradition of how leaders and teachers are brought him to points of realization about their own potential. And to do that, you have to push. You can't be comfortable and expect to discover something. You always make discoveries when you come out of your comfort zone. But we spend a lot of time trying to be comfortable with each other and to build trust, so that when it's time to try to push you to engage with what might be uncomfortable initially, right? You don't immediately rush out of the room, because there's this thing like, well, yesterday he was laughing and playing and jumping around and being silly. Do you know what I mean? So it takes great skill and empathy and compassion for another human being to be able to work in that way. If you don't have it, you're just bullying people.
Again, one of the first things that he asked students to do was to be blindfolded.
Yeah.
And to take a lump of clay, and from that lump of clay, to put, it was Mukata, wasn't it? The general? They built Mukata and then...
Janta. Yeah, from the Man Who Committed Thought.
The two characters there are the general and Janta. And Janta is the one whose goat has been taken, yeah?
Yeah.
And he has to go to the general and ask for the goat back, and he's denied justice.
Yeah.
In the story of the Man Who Committed
Thought. Yes.
So then they were asked to build the Janta and to put him into a position. But they had to do that blindfolded,
yeah.
So that they were just feeling their fingers,
yeah.
and making this thing out of clay,
yeah.
And then putting it out there as something, when the blindfolds were taken off, to be looked at, and for everybody to talk about. And they were fascinating, weren't they?
Yeah.
These extraordinarily detailed figures that the students created and put together. They put them out there. They were sitting in a circle, as I recall, and told their story about their posture.
Yeah.
And then Marcello said, and now squash them.
Yeah.
Take them and turn them back into a ball again. So that we didn't get fixated on, as it were, one performance or one, you know, all of performances continuously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The one idea that you had now can be then taken further into a different position. And just thinking about that, is that business of making something with the eyes closed, is that a technique that you use as an actor or as a teacher? You know, is that, where does that
again,
come from?
Again, it's just a principle of how do you sensitize, you know, people who are blind, for instance, their other senses become heightened.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, you know, Alison would say, look at the words on the paper, but don't think about them. Don't engage intellectually. Try to feel and approach this text from a different way.
Uh-huh.
So normally when you sculpt, you would see, you would look. But we were trying to engage memory into their fingers and to think about being physical. So they were having to create physical sculptures from their memories of what they had seen. So it wasn't necessarily about being, you know, naturalistically perfect, but about, again, just connecting with themselves and their idea of body and their idea of imagination or dreams, etc., etc. So by blindfolding them, they really had to concentrate on what they were doing and what they were feeling and what they had seen and their memory. And then when they got the shapes, they had to then watch each other. You see what I mean? Because they did it together. And if you look at what are now called primitive societies, that's what they do. They do things together. They create together. They make together. There's a practical application of art, and applied art. So that was all that was going on there. And then once they'd seen each other's postures, so they were then able to see different camera angles of the same experience that they had all seen and experienced together of the show that had been performed. You see what I mean? Yeah. So from there now, okay, put it away. Now we're going to take on some of the postures. We're going to embody some of the postures and the sensations of those postures. Because Machale asked them, don't write down what it means, just write down what the sensation of the postures. Is it exhilarating? Or is it depressed? Or is it sad? You know, just the feelings. So when we came to use the body, we were able to think of these emotional states as we created the bodies, all yet without engaging psychological or intellectual mechanisms, yeah. Which is what we're normally used to doing. But that did come later, you know, but it was about taking people slightly out of their comfort zones, which is what you have to do when you're approaching anything to do with interiority of difference of the other or interiority of your own difference. You know, you have to step out and look in a different way, which is what learning is about. So that's why we did that. Learning in different ways to approach learning.
You started the students drumming from the beginning and putting rhythms that you asked you, for example, on the first day, I think you gave everybody a different language. They each had a vocabulary that they then had to repeat on their drum, and it went round and the drums kept talking to each other. But then very soon, Ayo came into the rehearsal room. Could you talk about his contribution to the whole process? Ayo Tomas.
Ayo's speciality was to approach story, performance, creating together from drum and song. Mm-hmm. And when we, as I said with the griot, when a story is told, and the story is told within a context of a life transition, whether it's a wedding, a funeral, a birth, a christening, a president, refusing to leave power, you know, whatever, the community are going to be together because it involves the community, it affects the community, these life transitions, and also song, drum, movement is one of the unifying ritual ingredients that say we are all in the same space for a particular purpose. So, Ayo is a master musician, singer, and facilitator. He also has been in a different space. He's also moved from one space to the other, and he's experienced it teaching and facilitating, and he loves doing it. So, I knew it would happen. I mean, he came up with an amazing thing about what tragedy is for him in his context. Tragedy is not a final thing. Tragedy is, for instance, he used this phrase about the water has spilt, but the calabash did not break. In other words, in every tragedy, there's opportunity for onward movement, for joy. Because Marcello was then commenting on, Jabel and Ayo were playing music together as they were waiting for the students to get together, and they were just, communicating with each other. Right? Through song and through music, and I was having to follow him and improvise, so on and so forth. And Marcello said, what is this? This is joy. This is joy. So here was the Italian commenting on these two Africans interacting in Warwickshire. And then the conversation moved to what the place of joy was in the telling of a tragedy. Uh-huh. And Ayo was able to shed from his transcultural space a particular insight a very telling insight. And then we made a comparison. But then Maria, at the end, a year later, also said, I'm now much more aware of other cultures around me and how, as an individual and as a performer, these other things can be and should be brought in. So that was, I mean, I'm just a long-winded way of saying that's what Ayo brought. Ayo brought his way of experiencing story and experiencing human relationships, which then impacted the way we told the story. The story basically is based on African dance drama form. That's all it is. Which people have a freedom to take different or take the same roles as the story went along. So there wasn't a central character.
Yeah, so. Again, this was what was fascinating because I was participating in this week. So yeah. I was, part of me was observing, but most of the time I was just inside the experience. Yeah, yeah. And now as I reflect upon it a year later, what I'm aware of is that the story, the griot, the music, the drumming, the ritual, so the physicality, all of those things were happening all together, all the time. Yeah. But it was about halfway through the week that you then started giving students bits of text, bits of Othello text, and asking them to think of either using the text or improvising around the text, to start thinking about telling a whole story of Othello from start to finish. That was then using all of those elements, yeah. And the music was marking the story. The it was the way of creating the rhythm, if you will, of taking us through the Othello story that began right at the beginning, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And took us right the way to the end of the story with those students doing everything, and you just helping to manage to read, to think, to create more space for them to be inside the story. But it was an Othello that emerged out of a completely different, for them, cultural context. So they started moving from the beginning, they started dancing from the beginning, and all of the stories were connected, all of these individual scenes that took us right the way through the play were connected by movement, by song, by dance, but, in all of them, it was the village telling the story.
Yeah, the maybe the skill or the experience of the facilitators really has to be how far we are able to retain our playing ability and to try and communicate that to the group so that they feel that they can too. That's probably the simplest kind of key to it. To them being going, oh well, I can. Oh. In fact, on the DVD, I deliberately included a section of them, what I call the ensemble authoring the process, authoring the story, and it's just a snapshot of, I think, on the fourth or the fifth day, where it was about an hour and a half, where they had to go in their pairs or whatever. And now start piecing together what their segments of dialogue that they had chosen to that yep. they were going to, how they were yep. going to do it, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. Now many of these choices probably didn't end up because we then had to edit down, et cetera, et cetera. But that was the community authoring how they were going to tell that particular bit of the story within a situation of collective responsibility. So no, it didn't surprise me, because if you give people license to play, you say you can play. I mean, you know, or you can tell a story. You give them the license, and then you don't put constraints on how they should do it or how they should sound. You know, I mean, that's all the top performers do in any case, and everybody goes, "Well, that's really all they're doing is being themselves. That's all they're doing." That's all they're doing. That's all Ian McKellen's doing. That's all every single one of us are doing when we get up to tell a story. Except for, it's like, well, telling stories is just for the charismatic and tall and loud sounding or clipped sounding or whatever sounding or people who can memorize lots of roles, etc., etc. And then we come and admire them. Instead of, we should be going, well, I can do that too, and maybe you should come and admire me at some point. That way we democratize and we legitimize people into a more rounded space of accessing their own potential. So no, it didn't surprise me in the least, because they were given permission. And when you give people permission, you say it's okay to tell the story in this particular way, and you're not going to be judged, you know, because I'm doing it as well. You know, we're all doing it. In fact, that's what, who was it that said that? Ellen Turney actually said, when I looked around, I thought, hey, everybody else is making a fool of themselves. That's exactly what she said. Everybody else is making a fool of themselves, so hey, you know. And we didn't, nobody dropped out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you can't have people dropping out because of whatever reason.
But you were all players in the room as well. You know,
yeah.
There were no spectators in that room.
I think
everybody who came into that space became a participant.
Yeah, but it's not a surprise. Every major innovator, whether it's Grotowski, Shakespeare, whoever it is, they're having to work with people when they start off with, right? The theories and the accolades and their position in history comes later. But when they start off with people and with a ritual. And all those people are players. Shakespeare had players.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
He didn't have actors, he had players. And he bounced off them. They were probably, I mean, history doesn't record how much those players really influenced him. You know, it's a tragedy, actually. You know, that we don't have that, which is why this medium now is can potentially bring real breakthroughs in the power dynamics between cultural production, cultural decision-making agendas, and the rest of us that are involved in creating culture. Because at the moment, there's a split between unelected people who determine how culture should be and what culture should be and what is right and what is not right and how we're going to go about it, and the rest of us who come and appreciate or otherwise.
Okay, one last question then.
Yeah.
When do you start rehearsing Othello? And was there anything that came out of this whole experiment for you? Anything that's going to change your thinking about the Othello that you've rehearsed before? And I'm far too old, but can I audition for your Desdemona?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's one thing. The traditional casting of Desdemona, which has been determined by white middle-aged men from the West, really needs to be smashed. It needs to be smashed sky high. And it's one of the things that I flagged up with Catherine, and she agrees, and she's actually cast, you know, because I said Desdemona is a fair warrior. And so I think Desdemona should visibly embody a warrior vibe, however that does. But so yes.
So has she already cast Desdemona, or do I have a chance?
No.
Do I have a chance?
I'm not interested or particularly. I'm very honoured to be asked to play Othello, but I'm a storyteller. I'm not an Othello player.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore I'm continuing to provide many more opportunities for people to engage with Othello. So I'm sure that you would be, there's opportunities for you to play Desdemona or Othello. If you're willing to black up, I would rather you played Othello and I played Desdemona, so that you might see my cultural take on how Desdemona, in her situation, might react. Because my cultural take on women and my relationship with women in my cultural situation might actually help to, not legitimize, but to explain Desdemona's perceived weakness. She's perceived to, I've met people who've said, I don't understand why she just goes along with this horrible man, and you know, they just put down, and what's the matter with Shakespeare, etc., etc. You know, so by creating spaces so that different kinds of stories could be told rather than one legitimate space. Now we're going to have a Catherine Hunter Othello, which is really, well, who's Catherine Hunter or who is Michael Boyd? You know, we should be creating spaces galore for people to engage with telling stories. It shouldn't be the preserve of certain people or certain experts, right? Unless there's a way, did they pass an exam to say that you have the authority and the experience and the right even to be the leader of expressing the human condition? We're all part of the human condition and we all have legitimate right to express how we experience the human condition. So I am looking forward to the day when you can not only play Desdemona, but play Othello too. And so what's come out of this experience is that I must pursue creating multiple spaces and creating mechanisms whereby we can democratize cultural production. It's very important. It's really, really crucial, because otherwise cultural policy, cultural diversity policy, racial action, all these things end up, after lots of surveys have been done and so on and so forth, end up in a locked room with a few people who are highly illiterate in terms of shared history or any kind of post-colonial history or post-modern post-colonial history, having to make decisions that are going to affect the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years of how we see ourselves. And the more people that are involved in that process, like this, and so on and so forth, the better. Because I think that people in decision-making and gender positions should be able to tap into a constituency of agreement.
The point that you were just making, though, kind of takes you back round to your initial premise or your initial question about whether there is a way for Othello to escape from this text. And maybe as you rehearse and think through an Othello that you're going to play, maybe there will be that sense in which this is going to be the production where Othello really does escape from the text.
It's to be found. What I already can instinctively guess that I will encounter is his own complicity, right? But the text is so geared towards his, you know, his complicity is part of the DNA of the tragedy. It's you know, so unless Othello had a different character or the writer, the playwright, had a different conception of that stereotype, he's not going to get out. So what the narrative, what will be good was to see throughout the process, okay, I could have got out here, and I could have got out there, and I could have got out there, and could have got out there. In one of the workshops that we did in the Clapham before Capital, Michael, we went very deeply politically, we went right off text and, you know, too many narratives, etc. But Michael said it'll be interesting to see how the love of Othello keeps him in the story. Right, what keeps him in, etc., etc. I think at the end, a practical tool for that question would be to pose it to other people and to create situations where other people go, how could Othello get out, or how could I get out when I have been in a repeated habit, a situation, or how can countries get out of repeated, cul-de-sacs that they keep finding themselves in, as opposed to a play that will now show Othello getting out, you know. I already have scenarios whereby they had a baby all along and nobody knew about it, and they couldn't tell anybody about it. So Othello got out in that sense because he was trying to procreate. He was an outsider, alone, away from his family. He wanted to be more than himself. He met somebody, you see what I mean? That's why people get married and so on and so forth. That was curtailed. That just couldn't happen. So him getting out, there's so many dimensions to that. You know, are we gonna end up in a situation where we have Othello 2 in verse? Who knows? Do you know what I mean? You know, absolutely verse, because we have the linguistic capabilities right now to totally rewrite that story, as indeed Shakespeare did from Cynthia, you know, in the first place. You know, and then we're going to be in the situation where we're saying, well, who's insisting that Othello or any of the Shakespearean canon stay as it is? Who's insisting on that?
Well, you'll be pleased to know then, as a sort of a finishing of this conversation, that two of the people who were involved in the project that you did went on then,
yeah,
at the end of this year, one to rewrite Othello from the point of view of Lodovico,
yeah, 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 yeah,
and another one to rewrite all of the women's interactions as ways of rethinking,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
women's complicity in a story called Othello.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, well, it's a very interesting what will be. But having said all that, anyway, whatever the outcome of the production, I'm continuing hothousing throughout. So my experience is, I'm looking forward to keeping a diary, hothousing myself, yeah, in the role.
Yeah.
And going to a psychologist and other specific situations where Othello is having to come out of a situation and go in front of a panel, or, you know, it might be a panel of students, it might be a panel of immigration officials, you know, people pretend, yeah, or whatever, psychologists, to explain his what I've been through,
yeah,
that particular day. And I'm going to record all of that.
Yeah.
So, that's one kind of, the other thing that's come out of this is we now have a draft replicable template for, yeah, performance training or learning through creativity that is based on interdisciplinary paradigms of interculturality, so that we widen the vocabulary of tools that we have available to us. I mean, Maria was saying, this stuff is all around me.
Yeah.
This whole thing of hybridity and, you know, the process of hybridity. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so much interested in hybridity as an end, but it's the process of, yeah, becoming, you know, the, you know, how we get to, oh, I'm a hybrid, or this is a hybrid situation. You see what I'm saying? Just the process before that. And the process before that is about engaging in stories, telling stories, hearing other people's stories. The more civilized and effective we are about that, then maybe the more effective we can be at opening things up, like, you know, so that's a question behind Can Othello Get Out? Yeah, there's more work to be done anyway. There's so much work to be done.
There's more work to be done.